Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's Wednesday, which means it's time for the Front Three with me, Adam Boltwood, the one and only Lawrence McKenna.
Wednesday.
And the king of stats, Dave O'Brien.
Hello, chaps. Hello. How are you?
Doing very well. How are you, Dave?
Yeah, I'm excellent. Very, very good.
How are you, Lawrence?
I'm good. Well, I went to the game last night, so I was freezing, but it was good.
Oh, very exciting. We'll get onto that very shortly. We are going to be talking about the FA Cup. We're going to be talking about ticket prices, Mourinho, Leicester City, and Tottenham's sort of title challenge. Plus, journalist Owen O'Callaghan will be joining us later to discuss this week's talking point, which is Gary Neville's struggles at Valencia. Before all that, though, comment of the week. Now, if you want to be in with a shout for comment of the week, make sure you get on your podcast app and leave us a review and preferably a 5-star rating. On the iTunes reviews this week, we had Silver Linings saying, "I don't always listen to podcasts, but when I do, it's TF-free." Very good. Nice. We also had Ollie6000 saying, "Hashtag better than MSN," which is very nice as well.
MSN. Oh, that's my favourite messenger.
He is my favourite. But comment of the week has to go to Daniel D12345, who said, "I nicked my mate's phone to rate this 5 stars. I'm sure he'll love it."
What an absolute ledge.
Well done, Daniel. Appreciate
it very much. Not condoling stealing, though, but good work.
It's not theft. It's short-term borrowing.
Yeah, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Anyway, let's get into it. We have to start with the FA Cup, Lawrence. Liverpool obviously knocked out by West Ham last night in their fourth round replay. Klopp questioned the referee, said the Reds were the better team. You were there, obviously. Would you agree with that assessment?
I think Liverpool, again, lacked finishing, but... You know, over two legs, I think Liverpool can be very pleased with what they saw from their youth. De Sherry was fantastic. It was great to see Coutinho back for Liverpool. Liverpool fans are really getting on the back of Mignolet and Benteke right now, which I find difficult to be around because, you know, I think it's so short-termist in the way they treat the players. But West Ham also played well. And, you know, they had certain players in there that I think they'll consider to be fringe players. So I'd say overall, both sides, you know, if they would have gone through, I would have been happy with that. But having seen what West Ham did, I think, you know, they would like to win something in their final season at the Bowling Ground. I'm glad I got to go there before they sort of left because it's a great atmosphere. You know, if you go there, they don't have their own version of "You Never Walk Alone." "I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles" is very different, but the atmosphere is fantastic. And having gone with the FA again and seen it, you can go and see the video and how it all played out on their YouTube channel.
How exciting.
Yes. I think Klopp needs to... I think at some point we need to see the practicalities at Liverpool. And I imagine that will mean a new striker coming in alongside Benteke. The best combination of the whole night was Sturridge, Origi and Benteke, who were all furious with each other when they didn't get passes and the ball went over. And to some extent, I like to see that because... you know, as frustrating as it is, they look like a good combination. All three of them sort of bring something different. Yeah. So it was exciting, I think, last night to see what possibilities are.
What do you make of Liverpool's complete failure to continue to fail to defend set pieces then? Or is that kind of a bit harsh considering it was the last minute of the game? Everyone's exhausted.
You should have a man on the post there. And so some responsibility goes on to Klopp. It was the very last minute of 120 minutes. So I wouldn't say it's sort of normal... set piece, but and again, you know, West Ham are the kind of side who they would like to do well on set piece against Liverpool because they have two centre backs. It's Lucas and Ilery last night, alongside two relatively young wing-backs. So it's not that Liverpool that had their usual back line. And, it, you know, that will never be a starting lineup on the regular for Liverpool. Having made that excuse, or what is not an excuse, you know, Liverpool still need to be able to defend better than that. And I think they're disappointed for that reason. Mm. You know, they can deflect all you like, but I think ultimately Liverpool should have scored more in this game because they definitely created enough chances. And you know, credit to West Ham for doing what they did.
Do you think Liverpool fans are just sort of waiting for the season to be over now? Because
I don't think that would be the best approach to take.
Mm.
But it's obviously, you know, that's the way it is. In terms of the way that a lot of fans see it, I think they should be treating this as a very practical way of looking at the way that Klopp wants to play this side. So I think there's a lot of promise within there. You know, some people are predicting that it won't go so well for him, but I think when you're in this transitional phase, then it's very difficult to judge. You can go either way, essentially. Mm. I would say Liverpool fans are waiting for next season, but that would be wrong to do because actually the team there right now can do some very impressive things. So live in the moment.
Do you think that this team can do impressive things? Because they're struggling to do anything remotely impressive at the moment.
Well, no. I mean, having been at the game last night and seen some of those chances, I think there are some impressive players within that side. And there's some very promising youth that put themselves about well. You know, you had mm-hmm. Stewart in midfield, Teixeira just ahead of him, Smith, Liverpool's left back. And Flanagan on the other side, who still looks like he's a little bit too muscular to be playing at a fullback position. So there's a lot of promise there. And yeah, you know, I was impressed by what Liverpool did on the counter attack as well. Sturridge was on that. You know, I think that's fantastic for him.
Well, speaking of Liverpool, Lawrence, speaking of Liverpool fans, we can't ignore the ticket price row that sort of erupted.
Everyone's
in the past week. For those who don't know, in terms of Liverpool, what sparked the whole walkout protest at the weekend?
The £77 figure sparked the whole walkout process because, you know, Liverpool, you know, whatever your wage is, £77 is still quite a lot of money to go and see a team, whether they're top of the league or whether they're further down. And, you know, they compare that to other ticket prices. And you might say, you know, relatively, sometimes that's going to be competitive. That's not £77 for the entire season. It's a variable price, but that's £77, which is still a lot for someone in Liverpool. Doesn't mean Liverpool is poor. It just means that, you know, their relative wages.
Yeah, in general, that's a lot of money for anyone.
Even paying £77, whether it's entertaining football or not, is still a lot to go and see football. And the point is not so much the actual figure itself as why they've done that. And I think overall, it's a poor PR move by FSG.
Oh. Dreadful. To do.
And I think a lot of the press has jumped on that and sort of said, you know, they're not in touch with the fans. I think Ian Eyre dealt with it terribly by saying things like, you know, be careful what you wish for. The previous owner said that. It was a series of things where they gave a lot of bad headlines. And, you know, it could have been dealt with a lot better, almost in-house, if you like. If they'd have spoken directly to the fans, they'd make some very direct statements about why they're doing it and explained it much clearer than they did. I think people would sort of say, especially if they'd have said, this is what we're proposing, how would fans feel about this? I think that would have been a much better way to do it. So it's clear that they've retracted, they've almost introverted into themselves at this point and sort of gone down the route of, well, you know, we'll assess what we're doing here. But they must have had a reason that they thought they could justify that with. A lot of people are angry with FSG because that's clearly not in touch with, you know, the main supporter base. And it's clearly trying to attract a certain kind of fan. Mm-hmm. So overall, for me, I think there needs to be a lot more understanding between fans and the owners. They have not been terrible owners. They're not these, you know, they're not cowboys who come in to rip people off. But at the same time, they don't need that money. And all you need to do is compare it with Bayern Munich, who said, if we put ticket prices up another £10, we make £1 million more a year. Makes what's no million pounds
exactly.
to us?
Well, Dave, this feels like a real turning point, I think. I think it's fantastic the action the Liverpool fans took and the coverage it's gotten. Is very encouraging. And now the Football Supporters Federation is talking about planning a wave of mass walkouts by fans of all Premier League clubs in the future. It does feel like things could change. It feels like this is a key moment.
Yeah, hopefully it is. Yeah, it seems really strange at Liverpool. £77 to go and see Jordan Henderson and James Milner. No, thank you. But it's one of those things where it feels like Klopp's trying to get the fans really, you know, trying to get them on side in a way where... you know, he did the thing with the players and they saluted the fans or whatever. They bowed to the fans, which I really, really like. I like that type of thing. It's something that happens in Germany every single week. And it feels like Klopp's trying to get the fans in, trying to get them like really behind the team, really supporting the team. And then this move by the sort of the owners is completely crazy, going the other way, right? You know, charging X amount of money for tickets when you look around the world, you go to get a Bayern Munich season ticket for less than £100, the cheapest ticket. Like the average Premier League ticket price, I think it's the cheapest one's like £389 or something like that. And it, there was just a ridiculous amount of clubs that you could go to that'd be cheaper than that, like Real Madrid, Barcelona, Bayern Munich. And it's just crazy. I think the Premier League, the clubs should change their business model in a way where they should, you know, the ticket prices should go down because they're getting so much money and revenue from the TV deal. It just seems that they should be like, okay, let's, you know, let's get the fans to the games. Let's get the, you know, get the support, get the atmosphere going, and then deal with the money side of it with the TV money. It just seems a bit all over the place with all these Premier League clubs. I think there was 8 clubs that blocked the cap of the away prices for £30 last week. I think it was. It was Man United, Man City, Arsenal, Liverpool, and West Ham, I think. And these are all, you know, these are clubs that are going to be getting loads of money from the Champions League, loads of money from the Premier League.
Doesn't so really why make not? Sense, just, does it?
To, why not? Yeah, not well, like, it doesn't make sense. I don't understand.
We should say as well, it's not just England. It's not just the Premier League, although they are, without a doubt, the worst culprits and the ones that get the most flack. But we saw last night in Dortmund, Lawrence, that Dortmund fans were not happy themselves. They staged a protest, throwing tennis balls onto the pitch to disrupt the game, sort of boycotting the first 20 minutes of the match because they weren't happy with Stuttgart charging them. I think it was, you know, a quarter of ticket prices were over €70 for the away fans. So it's not just in England, this is elsewhere as well, even in Germany, where we're saying the system is much fairer.
I think to some extent it does make sense because it's what a lot of people have bought into. Although, you know, a lot of people are talking about whether they feel almost hijacked by the fact that football has been made into a business. You know, and people, you know, the whole football fans as consumers thing doesn't work. You know, if you want to go to another club, you can't just change your support midway through your life. So it doesn't work. These guys exist within a bubble, and you know, they justify it by saying trite phrases which don't really mean anything to each other. I don't believe that every owner is like that, but there's certainly sets of people who don't seem very understanding towards fans, and that's the problem. Is that you know, there's enough freedom of information right now that actually it just looks ignorant by the clubs when they act like this. You know, I understand, you know, why you want to make money from away fans and, you know, how you don't want to make it a comfortable situation for them, etc. But it still doesn't make sense to be charging such extortionate prices. There's not much more that anyone can add to the conversation until someone actually does something about it. So what are clubs going to do about it?
This is what I think is almost exciting. Really. This feels like this is the turning point, potentially. Obviously, it could go either way.
Yeah.
But if these protests continue, if they continue to grow and they hit boards and they hit clubs where it hurts, be it in their wallets or be it, you know, empty stands, that could make a massive difference. So,
the thing is, but we've already concluded, and I think, you know, it would be a stupid point to say, look, they can fill a stadium no matter what, whether the regular fans go or not. The point would be that there are, to some extent, it's like a picket line. There are, you know, whether you want to cross the picket line or not, there will be people who want to go into the stadium, whether the club charges too much or not. Because, you know, it might be their only time going to see the club and those kind of things. But the point is, that's not a sustainable business model. You can't keep screwing your fans over and expect them to come back. So, you know, when people say enough is enough, I think they're right in saying that. And, you know, 20's plenty and all these kind of campaigns, it just makes sense to, you know, be kind to the people who you're servicing here. Because there just doesn't seem to be enough thought in the long-term process. And, you know, that's what the money and those kind of things create. They create this kind of atmosphere.
I think on the smallest level so far, it's encouraging that, you know, the Liverpool hierarchy apparently held a meeting over the new ticket structure after the walkouts. That sort of sparked them to actually...
But you'd have hoped they'd have done it before.
You'd
have hoped that it wouldn't have
to. I think they did.
Yeah, because it's
they
bad.
They have to be made to listen. They're not going to listen by themselves because, as you say, they don't put enough consideration into it. But listen, fingers crossed. Hopefully, things are going to be moving in the right direction from now on. Moving on, Dave. A little bit of news this morning. Back page of 3 of the biggest newspapers over here in the UK saying Jose Mourinho has told his close friends he's joining Manchester United at the end of the season. Are you happy and do you know it, Dave?
I'm definitely happy, and I do know it. I think
supposed
that we've
to clap your hands, mate. That's, you know, nice. Nice.
With Guardiola coming into the Premier League, there's only one answer. I said it before, and I'll say it again. It's got to be Mourinho. I think that we've got to, you know, as a United fan base, we've got to appreciate other contrasting styles of football, and Mourinho is going to be another one. I think what we've forgotten about Mourinho is that he's a winner, and he will get a team to win, and he'll get players to overperform.
We forgot that? Because they didn't win when he left. But I get what your point is.
You know what I mean? Like, the first 2 years Mourinho's there are ridiculous in terms of getting the most out of these players. You know, look at all the young players at United, like the likes of Martial, the likes of Memphis Depay. They'll be perfect under Mourinho. Mourinho is a really good counter-attacking manager. These players have pace. They're young. They want to learn. They could be, you know, that's the real sort of interesting thing there, that, yes, we've seen Man City got dismantled at the weekend against Leicester City, playing a very, like, sort of dogged counter-attacking style. When Guardiola comes in, it's going to take that possession obsession even further. So with the only answer is Mourinho. I'm playing on the counter-attack and sort of enjoying that. I think that's the thing. It's got to... I feel that, football at the moment, it's sort of a lot of hatred around United at the moment. Like, there's a lot of, oh, this is going wrong, that's going wrong. I'm included. I've vented a lot of anger on this podcast of late, but I feel that with Mourinho, you know, let's just get behind him and support him and, you know, love his style of football. I really enjoyed this weekend, Leicester City versus Man City, because it was the two contrasting styles, and then one style won over the other. And that's why it was so interesting. Tactically, it was so, so interesting. You know, playing that 4-4-2 block, counter-attacking that certain way. We all know what Leicester City are going to do, yet they're still doing it. And I think that's Mourinho will be similar to that, where he'll, you know, in the big games, he will, play very negatively, but he'll win those big games.
Speaking the thing, of winning. Leicester, Dave, you're talking about how they absolutely destroyed Man City at the weekend. They're now, surely, are they favourites for the title now?
I'm going to have to go back on what I've been saying for the last like 3 months, because I do believe now.
You believe? Dave believes.
I actually believe. After watching that performance against Man City, it was absolutely brilliant. You know, how many... You know, what I really, really liked as well is just the structure of that team and how quickly they get back into shape. It's so, so quick. The transition going forward is rapid, and the transition getting back into defence is just fantastic. And it's so... That's what we need. That's what we need our big English teams to do in Europe. They just need to do what Leicester City are doing. Play that way. Get compact. Look for the balls over the top. Look for, you know, having someone like Mahrez to get the ball to his feet and then for him to break. Gives them that sort of second dimension. Obviously, they've got the Vardy pace over the top or around the corner option. But Mahrez, you know, what a player this season. What a player. Definitely, for me, he's definitely my player of the year. And that goal, fantastic. You know, beating two players.
Superb,
a lovely step over. Bangs it in the top corner. And then as well for the first goal as well, he basically, like, you know, he did cross the ball and whatever, was a bit of a mistake for Man City. But before that, to win the free kick, go back and watch that. He absolutely burns Kolarov on the outside. Absolutely destroys him. We all think Mahrez is, you know, stronger left foot, comes inside, goes the other way, gets around him. It's just like, I didn't think that I'd ever see a team that can compete at this level for this long. Always thought they're going to drop off. Always going to thought they'd drop off. And it's looking like that they're still going.
Lawrence, what about a team that plays that style as well? Because I thought they're playing this blistering counter-attacking style. You know, absolutely incredible. But I was shocked that Man City weren't wiser to that and they failed to deal with that.
I mean, see, the thing is with Leicester, right, does anyone else have this feeling, you know, when they go into the game, so people sort of go, right, this will be where they trip up. Because Man City have got this, and this.
Is that, and then just underestimating them still?
I don't know if it's underestimation. I think it's, I think we talk in very sort of, to some extent it's underestimating, but I think what I'm saying is, we talk in very sort of cliche terms in football, and you know there are some truisms which sort of keep going, which I agree with. You know, if Leicester do keep this going, then it will be very impressive, because it's one of those things that goes against the grain of everything else we've seen in football. You get this feeling post match of, well, actually, yeah, that does make sense. So I think it's more that the analysis needs to take a step further, and you know, we need to find the right framework to fit this Leicester side around to be able to analyse them. So when you sort of go to Ranieri and all the different variables, you see why it works, and you can see why it works for Mahrez and why it works for Vardy, and how there will be certain teams that will work well against that. But that's been the case with the Premier League entirely this season, that, you know, there are some things that look unpredictable, but actually when you look back post-game, you know, I know hindsight is 20/20, but the point would be, you can't, you know, you sort of go, yeah, that works perfectly. Of course, that's why Leicester won this game. And so it seems that Ranieri has the foresight to be able to outthink these managers. And what I would say is, whilst it seems like that can go on forever, that has to be a sustainable model.
Mm.
And there's going to have to be investment that's made by Leicester in terms of wages and those sorts of things to make that sustainable and to make that go on in the long term. Because Man City will buy, Manchester United will buy, Liverpool will buy, Spurs will continue to get better, and other teams will continue to get better around them. And we've seen other teams, you know, in inverted commas, overachieve, because I think that's patronizing to Leicester, say they're overachieving right now.
Mm-hmm.
But, it, you know, there has to be something that keeps that going. But in this very moment, it doesn't take away from the immediate achievement, and it doesn't take away from them possibly winning this title.
It's a really interesting point of, like, where do they go next, right? You know, if they do win the title, let's say they do win the title, and then they keep Vardy, because he's obviously signed a new deal, you know, potentially they'll keep him. Mahrez, if they keep Mahrez as well, what would I do to sort of develop the side further? I'd say probably you get two new centre-backs in. Robert Huth and Wes Morgan have been very, very good, but they are susceptible to, you know, players running at them, pace. We saw a few moments against Man City where Aguero, when he got a little bit of steam, you're thinking, uh-oh, boy, those two centre-halves are in trouble. So I'd upgrade those two. I'd also look for another outlet. I think that, you know, Mahrez is quality on the right. Vardy's good up top. I think an attacking midfielder or maybe a second striker that gives them a little bit more of a goal threat, you know, to soften the burden to Mahrez and Vardy, that would be quite good. So, you know, attacking mid, two centre-backs. So I had a question from a fella from Peru on Twitter, and I thought it was incredible. A lad from Peru asking me a question. So I'm going to answer his question. That was my answer for his question there, what I'd do to improve Leicester City.
Dave there, using this as his own public speak box. Well done, Dave.
We're talking about the title challenge here. The other team, looking like they could be up there, guys. The mighty Spurs. Second place at the moment. We said a few weeks ago, you know, if they avoided the sort of classic Spursy results against Sunderland, Palace, Norwich, Watford, you know, we could sort of maybe include them in the conversation of a realistic title contender. I'm not letting myself believe just yet, but Lawrence, what are your thoughts? Do you think Spurs are in there? 5 points behind Leicester at the moment?
Well, they're as in there as anyone else, aren't they? And again, it's changing the perception and where we saw things before. You know, that there's a really interesting media theory about how whenever a new piece of technology comes along, we as humans, we find it very hard to judge what the effect of that is going to be. And you can very much transpose that onto football. So, for instance, when the internet came along, we looked at the technology that had come in the past and we thought, right, how's that going to fit in with everything else? But as it evolves, it's very difficult. It becomes easier to see how it's actually affecting everything else. And I think you can say the same with Pochettino. It's very difficult to predict exactly how it was going to go with Spurs and how he was going to change the mentality, because that seemed so fixed. And I think, you know, what I said at the beginning of the season, I still stand by the Spurs mentality. And Adam, you got to say this, it's changed under Pochettino. And, you know, it looked very unlikely that he'd be able to do that because of everything else that had happened at certain teams. But now it seems sort of very realistic and seems very sort of, again, oh yeah, of course that's happening because of everything that's going on.
For me, I was disagreeing at the start of the season that the mentality was the biggest problem for Spurs. I think the club was poorly run.
Sure, I mean, you can change your words now, mate, but the podcast...
No, I think I did say I disagree the biggest problem for Spurs is mentality, because we had so many awful players, so much dead wood, the money had been horribly misspent, managers were being sacked left, right and centre, the right managers weren't being appointed. But as soon as you appoint the right manager who has, you know, the right ideas, gets rid of all the bad eggs, as Harry Kane called them this week, brings through young players with a lot of promise, that the transfer policy is actually something based on, you know, something tangible, something clever, everything comes together. And I mean, you see something similar at Leicester as well. As soon as they get the right manager in, as soon as the tactics are right, the personnel's right, all the conditions are in place to make a success of it. I feel like
ties in that whole famous Steve Jobs speech where he says you can only really join the dots backwards. But that's maybe part of the point of being a manager, I guess, is that you have to be able to look forward and say, right, we want to reach this dot, and this dot. And if your communication is clear and your vision is clear, then very often that will happen if you have people around you who share that vision.
The problem for Spurs may be the massive advantage for Leicester. We're talking about everything falling into place, the conditions being right. Leicester have 13 league games left to play.
Mm-hmm.
The likes of Spurs, Manchester City, still in the Europa League, still in cup competitions. Do you think that's going to have a big impact on the title race? Because for Leicester, it's potentially a lot simpler. They don't have to play anyone else, I think, in the top five from now until the end of the season.
Yeah. Although you'd say the top five is probably some of their easiest matches this season.
Well, you know, you could say that.
Because the point would be, you know, there is a big relegation battle going on. There are a lot of clubs that are susceptible to that right now. That makes those the harder to judge games almost.
Interesting.
The ubiquity of sort of wealth at the top of the table has almost led to a kind of an inertia that's set in. And, you know, we've leveled that at Man City for years, but we haven't leveled that at Chelsea or Liverpool or any of those other guys.
Mm.
And now, looking at the way the table lies, you know, we were saying Liverpool, Man City and Arsenal look like the hardest games. No, it's the games after that. The clubs who are worried about relegation.
I'm feeling quite confident going into this weekend against Manchester City. Obviously a huge weekend. Spurs v Manchester City first, Dave. I'm thinking Spurs are going to win this one. How are you feeling? What's your prediction?
Well, if City sort of set their midfield out like they did against Leicester, they're going to get hammered on the counter-attack. You know, it was ridiculous. Why have you got a single holding Fernandinho who isn't even a holding midfielder, and then there's no protection in front of him from the rest of the midfield? No Fabian Delph, David Silva and Yaya Toure. Defensively, they were rotten against Leicester City. So much space in there. If you're giving that space to the likes of Christian Eriksen, Harry Kane, you know, Dele Alli, even Eric Lamella this season on the break, that is just, you know, that's going to be ludicrous. And Spurs, you know, could pull off a shot. Is it at Tottenham, right, Adam? Is that why Art Lane?
I believe it is at Manchester City.
It is at Man City.
Mm. And that's why I'm feeling confident. Usually going to the Etihad is difficult.
But then the thing with City is their form at home has been ridiculously good. Their form away, apart from the Leicester City defeat.
Apart from Leicester City.
so it's going to be a corker.
Who's going to win? Go on. Spurs or City? Or draw?
I'm going to go City. I'm sorry, mate.
Oh, what?
I'm sorry. Lawrence, God, I'm going to go
Spurs.
I've always liked you, Lawrence. What about Arsenal-Leicester, which is obviously a massive game? I think Leicester are going to win because I think Arsenal won't change their style of play. They won't adapt to counter Leicester. And Leicester will take advantage of that.
I'm going to go with a draw.
Oh!
1-1.
I think Leicester are going to do it. And then, you know, it's on. It's like really.
It's really on.
They're, you know, they're going to do it. I really think they're going to do it. I feel like they've got so much momentum.
This is a six-pointer because they're playing someone who's on for the title.
In many ways. That's very exciting.
Well, no, in one way.
I'm going for Leicester to win. Dave, you're going for a draw. Lawrence, what are you going for? Massive game.
You know what's funny is you always make the prediction on the podcast and afterwards you listen to it and go, that's not what I meant.
Massively wrong.
I'm so wrong. We almost need a podcast, so like a post-podcast podcast that when you listen to it, then you go, no. Okay, now let's record the podcast.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to go with Dave and go draw. I think it'll be like a 1-1. I think Arsenal have probably got the best chance of the three teams of winning against Leicester, but I think...
It destroyed them, though. Arsenal did destroy them in the reverse fixture, right? They won 5-3.
Good point, but that was a while ago nowadays.
Mm.
True.
Arsenal have only won one of the last five.
Yeah.
So
this is classic Arsenal now.
This is Arsenal, now make or break. And when it's make or break for Arsenal, you wouldn't bank on them to get the result they need.
They always have that one result where it sort of goes, make! And then it's, break!
Yeah. So, we're going to do it. Oh, no, wait.
It's we're going to... Everybody, we've not been sucked over the edge of the waterfall. Oh, fuck! and then obviously Arsenal are going in for Champions League as well.
Indeed,
God, it's all set up for Arsenal to win this 1-2-1, isn't it?
Yeah, it's. No, I'm gonna change my prediction. I'm gonna unpredict my predict, and I'm gonna say Arsenal are gonna win.
What a salesman! Lawrence wins again.
Wow, Jesus.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
That's why I'm going to go Leicester.
you've changed as well.
No, all I'm saying, I think it'll end as a draw. But I've had that feeling too often this season, where I've looked back at a game and I've gone, of course it finished, 5-3. Of course it did.
Well, I'm going for Leicester win. Dave, you're going for an Arsenal win, apparently. Lawrence, you're going for a draw. The two guys were wrong at buying the points next week. That's what I say.
Uh-oh.
Anyway, listen, let us know your score predictions on Twitter. Hit us up at the Front Three. Get your questions in as well for Saturday's Q&A podcast. For now, though, we're moving on to the talking point. We're talking to Owen O'Callaghan about Gary Neville at Valencia. Owen, welcome to the Front Three.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, the pressure is mounting on Gary Neville at the moment. 9 league games, 0 wins, back-to-back defeats against relegation candidate Sporting Gijón. I think that's how you say it. And Betis, not to mention a 7-0 defeat to Barcelona in the Copa del Rey first leg, I should say. It's not exactly going as planned at the moment, is it?
No, certainly not. I think Neville has always made a name for himself as a perfectionist and someone who has this incredible work ethic and drive and determination to succeed no matter what the circumstance. But he's obviously finding that management is a little bit different. You don't get the same sort of benefits, particularly when you're young and inexperienced and raw as you would do when he was a player or when he was a pundit or whatever it was. Management has its own rules. And I think he's finding that out the hard way. I mean, I think when he arrived, he made a point of saying, listen, give me time and judge me in a number of months. And I'm not going to make up your minds within a couple of weeks. And if results go a certain way. But I think he's been proven to be absolutely correct, actually, because that's exactly what's happened. I think that there's a lot going on at Valencia. It's an intriguing club for a number of reasons. And essentially, he walked into a little bit of a perfect storm. I think it's funny because, once the cracks start appearing, there's very little wiggle room. It's very, very easy for players to start looking around and looking at maybe an atmosphere changing. Neville as a foreigner, as an outsider in there, someone who still struggles with communication issues. It's very, very difficult to stem the bleeding once it starts. And I think that when you look at Neville and what inevitably is going to happen to him here, you would have to fear for his job security at this stage.
Do you think we put a little bit too much importance on the manager sometimes? And I know obviously we're here to talk about Gary Neville, but when he first went in there, it was very clear that the situation wasn't a great one at Valencia because of everything that was going on. And it seems the English media, because we only really see Gary Neville and La Liga doesn't have the same prominence, we give all the prominence, it seems, to Gary Neville and not maybe the other area, which maybe requires a bit more research.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, you always probably work on this premise that managers are in charge of everything at a club. And I think that maybe even managers, particularly when they're inexperienced, go into places thinking that as well, that they walk into an organization and think, well, I'm the manager here, so therefore I have full control over everything. And I'm sure that Neville probably felt that with his relationship with Peter Lim, that there was a kind of a support there for him, his brother already there. But I think what he's finding out is that, I mean, particularly in the continent, you could argue, obviously, it's the same in Premier League clubs and in other leagues around the world. It's so political and that everything is kind of balanced on a knife's edge that, you've got outside influences, you've got investors, you've got stakeholders. So that when you go into an office and you're plotting the weekend and you're preparing for a game, doing your video analysis and your tactics and you walk into a dressing room, there's so many other elements at play. I mean, you look at Spain, you look at a club like Real Madrid, where it's not really about a manager. It's not about tactical nous or whether or not you can coach a team, but it's about personality and it's about whether or not the owner likes you. So I think that Neville, you could probably argue that he's a little bit romantic. I'm sure he probably claims of himself as an eternal optimist. He probably go into Valencia thinking, I'm the right person for this job. I can do it. I can turn it around. I can make miracles. Because you look at what he's like as a personality. I'm sure you look at Class of 92 as a prime example where he probably looked at Beckham. He looked at the players around him thinking, I can't survive here unless I work really hard and I can succeed and I can do it. And when you start getting results like that, probably it feeds into your self-confidence that you can go and you can magic anywhere. But I think, as I said at the top, the more you watch football and the more you kind of invest your time in it, the more that it's just such a a really, really difficult thing to get your head around sometimes, that there's no rational thinking, really. There's less and less rational thinking, I think, in football clubs these days anyway.
What would you say is sort of the main reason it's going wrong for you in that way? Like, some people are saying it's the squad's badly assembled, it doesn't have the players to bring success to the club. You know, people saying there's Jorge Mendes' fingerprints all over it, or some are pointing to the language barrier for Gary Neville.
I think it's probably a number of those things, and you put them all together. I mean, I think the language. I mean, surely, I mean, you go into a dressing room and you're trying to communicate with players, you're trying to communicate with staff, you're trying to get a message across. And I think the big thing about Gary Neville is that he's so good at communicating. You know, he's such a good talker. I imagine when you're in his presence, we've seen him on Monday Night Football. You know, he's so analytical, very specific, very astute and intelligent with what he has to say. And that comes from language. And it's very, very difficult to do that in your first language, not to mind the language that you're trying to learn. I'm sure that he can only count on buzzwords for the moment to try to get a team pulling together on a pitch and trying to get across tactical instructions. I think the general consensus is that performances have been really poor. And I think that... what we also have to remember is that, I mean, he's arrived mid-season as well. It comes back to everything, you know, when he took that job originally, that it just looked so difficult. Players, you know, invest so much in momentum, you know, and if you get a couple of results that are good, suddenly things start to turn around and you've got players believing in themselves, a bit of confidence. When he walks in there and you get a couple of bad results straight away, I think players are probably looking at him going, this isn't working out, is it?
No new manager bump, essentially, which might be a myth in the first place.
It's weird, isn't it? How you always you anticipated that Neville was going to walk in, there was going to be an immediate response, but it almost seemed to be that even his draws were painted negatively. You know, he went on that run of kind of not winning games, and while he's gone X amount of time without a win in La Liga. And you just kind of felt that was a bit funny that, well, okay, you know, he's a man in a new environment, and it's very, very new for him. I mean, I remember in that Yahoo column that I wrote, just mentioning Roy Keane, you know, when he took over at Sunderland and having to come to terms with things, like Keane struggled to come to terms with the fact that he had an office and a secretary. These kind of weird things that come into your mind. So, you know, you transplant that to a different country, a different city, where you're trying to bed in and settle in, and people are going, Neville, you've drawn a couple, lad. You know, you've got to improve things here. You know, I just felt it was a little bit unfair and a bit misguided. But, when you find yourself in a funk, it's just so difficult to struggle to get yourself out. And I mean, he's just looking for a result. He's almost like a goal scorer on a barren run. You know, you're just hoping that a shot gets
something goes in,
starts or something, and suddenly he has that feeling of euphoria back. And I think, you know, you're looking ahead to the weekend and an Espanyol game. You're just really, really desperately hoping that Neville gets one, because I just think that he made such a brave decision in going there in the first place, that he's owed a bit of a break, and he's owed, at the very minimum, he's owed people kind of relaxing the criticism, even if it is just for a weekend.
Dave, statistically, have you looked into Valencia at all and how it's played out for Neville?
I think, well, obviously, since he's taken over, he's got the worst record. He's only picked up 5 points in the league. Interestingly enough, though, Espanyol as well, they've only picked up 5 points in that same time frame. For me, it's there's a lack of goals. There's a lack of clean sheets. It's just it's not coming together. And I do think, you know, like, it's a language barrier. I think that's a massive thing. You know, going to it's a new profession for him in a way. You know, he has done the TV stuff, but now he's going into this new profession of actually being a manager. You know, it was touched on before, the similar to the Roy Keane stuff. Are we going to see that the whole of the class of 92 can't actually manage and they were only good players?
Well, I mean, it is, that's hard, isn't it, though, to compare the two, because, you know, these would all still be very young managers, even if they were just coming into management and hadn't played at all. They'd still be cutting their teeth. And that's what makes me think, does Neville see it slightly differently to the way that everyone else is painting it? I know he would obviously always say he takes the job very seriously, but, you know, I'd be interested to know what you think about the idea that Neville has always been a very practical footballer, like you were saying. Does he see this as a practice in football? And essentially, he was afforded time and some experimentation by Peter Lim because, well, what else did Valencia have? They were losing out anyway. So it was almost a risk, which if it goes wrong for Neville, there's almost very little bad that can happen, because he can go back to a punditry job, or he can go back to coaching England. And then a few years down the line, he's got the experience of being at a top club. He's made connections. And essentially, Gary Neville's reputation isn't really ruined by this, because it's already a club that's in crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when he took the job initially, you know, he was quite philosophical in the fact that he said that whatever this would be, it would be an experience, you know, and he'll probably look to it as a big learning
curve. What an experience.
What an experience, isn't it? And I remember when he took the job, I wrote a piece about how Neville, you know, is the unlikely lad. You know, he's always been that way, that you look at his footballing career, he never looked like a footballer. You know, he never, when you compare, obviously you probably would say, well, did Nicky Butt look like a footballer? Which isn't a good counter argument. But
no one knows what Nicky Butt looks like now.
Yeah, that's in the grand problem. Context of the class of 92, that Neville always felt that he had ground to make up. And you know, Lee Sharp always told that story about, you know, Neville practicing his throws against the wall of the cliff, you know, that, you know, when Sharpie was going out on the Raz. I think what you see with Neville now is his pride being dented a little bit, because I think you always pride yourself on an ethic, and you know, he probably feels that he's in some way he's cracked this football thing. You know, he's played the game, he's won an enormous amount, he's gone into punditry and it's been a success, and everything else that he's done in his career, you look at the external interests, the hotel business, helping the homeless. He really has made a success of lots of things that people have found immensely difficult. So I think that when he finds himself in this sort of situation, and particularly in the Spanish press, when he's based locally, obviously he has a reputation in the UK, which is fine. In Spain, well, he's just a bit of a Johnny Foreigner. He's an outsider. Probably you'd have a large portion of that Valencia fan base who didn't really want him to be at the club anyway. So it would be immensely interesting to know, when he's there going into work, you know, and into a training session first thing in the morning, how much he's absorbing of that kind of negativity that's around him. Because players are so good at compartmentalizing, pushing criticism far away that they don't have to worry about it. But when you're a manager and when you're bearing the brunt all the time, surely that begins to seep in. And I'm sure that Neville is beginning to feel that in a slightly different way that he's never had before.
I'm not sure. Lawrence, you were sort of saying there about how his reputation is almost untarnished. I mean, would you agree with that? I'd say, I don't agree with that at all. I'd say his reputation has taken a bit of a battering.
For who? For who would you say rates Neville lower because of what he's done at Valencia?
Obviously the Spanish press and the Spanish fans.
The Spanish press are, you might as well ask the cat. It's not worth the paper it's written on in Marca.
You've just been completely written off by Lawrence Miguel. There
are certain people you respect in Spain, but then there's also people who write ridiculous things, and they're so changeable. It's the same as a lot of the UK presses. So if I don't care about what my reputation is like in the Sun, it's a rag. I don't care about what my reputation is like to Rupert Murdoch.
But I'd say regardless of how you feel about the Sun and whether you rate them or not, the media is obviously very powerful and influential. And when everyone in Spain is criticising Neville, and people over here now starting to argue how his reputation has been tarnished, it doesn't matter whether you rate them. That influence is having.
But the point is, reputation is so changeable like that. Reputation changes in a few seconds.
And how long has he been there for? What, 6 weeks, 7 weeks, 8 weeks?
But that would be my point, is that with time, time's a great healer for these sorts of things. And you'd imagine that when Neville then steps back away from this job, then that'll change. I think the media is so interested in putting itself at the centre of all this and being the ones that say, you've had your reputation tarnished. We remember what happened when John Terry was at the centre of the whole, you know, should he be England captain thing. Where did the pressure come from? Didn't come from internally at the FA. Didn't come from Chelsea. Didn't come from John Terry himself. It came from a baying press that wanted to see him fail, that wanted to see his downfall, because it sells papers. And if you can change someone's reputation, you've got a media narrative that you can sell papers for weeks for.
What do you make of that? Owen, do you think people want to see Neville fail?
I think there's always a lot of people who are ready to say, "I told you so." I do feel that everything changes so quickly in football. And I think that that's what, I mean, people don't remember, you know, it's like, not to bring it all back to something I've written, but in that Yahoo column about Neville, like I mentioned, Andrew Villas-Boas as an example, you know, when he came to the Premier League, At 33 years old, you know, he just won a Portuguese title in the Europa League. And 33, I mean, it's only when you say it now out loud, you go, that is absolutely ridiculous. Comes to a Premier League and already he's painted as a little bit strange. You know, he stayed late hours in the training ground. And he's kind of portrayed as a different character, and suddenly it's something to be suspicious of.
Same with Benitez in London. Journalists, when he first came to Chelsea, were saying, I didn't realise he was so nice. And you're like, well, you're not doing your job then, mate.
Yeah. I'm not saying these papers and the media's right, but I'm saying they have an influence.
Well, then it's wrong.
Kind of where Neville's coming from then, right? He's the first TV pundit that's moved into being a manager. And now he is getting sort of challenged by, you know, Hearn and Crespo and the press is saying, oh, Neville was too harsh on players. But no, he wasn't. He was doing the right thing. I think it's just, like Ian was saying, it's that development and it's the... He might have failed this time, but next time he'll come back and he'll be stronger and he'll have worked harder on his, you know, maybe his management, like the sort of, you know, the Roy Keane type stuff again, working on the little things, the little factors to get players up. That's a massive thing as well, the communication. How do you put your ideas across in Spanish when you've learnt Spanish for what, probably like a month, 2 months? How can you explain like tactical intricacies to those players?
Well, because maybe he would have learned from other people who had expressed themselves in other languages. And having worked with a number of coaches, and you know, I know his entire time at Manchester United was under Sir Alex. Yeah. There were a lot of languages that went through there in that time. And he's seen managers and people communicate in foreign languages and still manage to tell a player, this is what I want.
Let me ask you this now. We're talking about the whole Gary Neville situation. Do you think he made a mistake in going to Valencia, that it was such a huge task that it was almost a lose-lose situation for him?
You know what? I think the more that you look around the football industry and the more you're kind of part of it, whether or not you want to be or not, the more you really respect people who make brave decisions. And I think that because, you know, it's such a closed shop at times. You know, you look at the same managerial merry-go-round, particularly at championship clubs and lower leagues, you know, the same kind of managers crop up just at different clubs. It's like Neil Warnock this morning linked with Rotherham. You know, there's these same faces crop up. Particularly in the wider context of young coaches, I do feel that there's a bit of a weirdness that's creeping into a game. You saw it with Derby this week and Paul Clement. Young coaches who are intelligent and astute and need time to develop, surely you need to nurture them the same way that young players who show potential, you want to wrap them in cotton wool. I think that the big thing about someone like Gary Neville is, he's a young guy, but so beloved by so many people within the game. And now he's had this situation that football in some ways kind of spat him back out a little bit. Whereas, you know, as someone who has so much to give and so much to offer, he's kind of been shunned, and he certainly hasn't been allowed the time to properly flourish. I'm saying this with an inevitable kind of sacking in his short term, I would presume. You know, maybe I'll be proved wrong on that. So I think that's the one thing. But Neville, I really can't see him having made a mistake. I don't think that he'll look upon it as a mistake either, even though it'll probably end in people tagging him as a failure or, you know, something like that. I'm sure that he'll be very open about it as well. You know, if that day comes when he is sat by Valencia, I'm sure he will be in a column with a newspaper or on TV with Sky or someone else, talking about what he felt went wrong, what he felt, you know, went against him, and maybe something that he didn't do right, and that maybe he's learned. I think he's very open about stuff like that. He's a bit of a talker, and I'm sure that's what we'll hear from Neville. And I really can't see him saying that this was anything other than a positive step and something to kind of progress his career with ultimately.
His hard work has earned him that. Where do you think Valencia go from here?
That's a big question, isn't it? Yeah. I think I was looking at, you know, I was looking at this from kind of a Valencia angle the other day, where you're always faced with this situation where, are we now so close to relegation that we have to think about sacking Neville and replacing someone to keep us in the top flight? And
that's, he says it's free.
Yeah, it's a strange one, and you know what you're hoping as well. You're looking at what, March is around the corner. You know, 2 months left of a season. You know, you're looking for someone to go in. You're obviously looking as your next manager, someone to go in there with a vast amount of experience, who has a reputation and will get an instant response from players. So I'm sure the shortlist is particularly small of candidates who could do that at a club like Valencia. Benitez is an obvious name. But you would have to look at the ownership of this decision as well. You know, to bring in a novice, you know, at an early juncture, well, midway through a season, and to see where the club has gone. I really, ultimately, Neville shoulders some of the blame, but there has to be a collective decision made higher up in terms of, here's a young coach, may not go according to plan for a first few months. You know, obviously, you know, that's a collective decision that needs to be scrutinised. So as much as Neville is the fall guy, you have to look at the other people responsible for putting him in that position to begin with as well.
You mentioned your column earlier for Yahoo, and you sort of talked about in that about the big concern is the treatment of young managers, as you've mentioned there. So is the problem almost not you know, the issues that Neville faces at Valencia, but the issues in the wider game as a whole? We're talking about the media there. We're talking about how young managers don't last more than a few months, they're never given a chance. Is that the bigger concern in all of this?
Ian, like, I have to say, I mean, you look at this season, particularly the last couple of months, you know, Gary Monk at Swansea, you know, Gary Monk wasn't afforded a bad patch. You know, as in, he was experiencing a bad patch with Swansea, but it resulted in his dismissal. You know, as in, the window is so small now where, you know, Gary Monk had so much credit at Swansea. He was so much in credit for what he had done. He had kept them up when he took over from Loudrup, which didn't look like was going to happen for a long time. In his second season, he gets them eighth in the Premier League. This season begins. Swansea started the campaign very, very brightly. You know, some newspapers whispering it gently that it wouldn't be outside the realms of possibility that Gary Monk could be teed up for the post-Hodgson England setup. And then you fast forward a couple of months later and Monk is out of a job. And you look at, well, Swansea, you know, a club icon had given so much to them as a coach. I mean, what's the worst thing that he did for Swansea? You know, experience a rough spell. Every manager goes through it. Swansea got rid of him. You know, you would have to say that that's absolutely insane stuff. You know, Paul Clement this week. You know, if anyone could tell me Mel Morris's interview with BBC and that it made any sense whatsoever, I mean, the guy, I mean, I've watched it about six or seven times now.
Still can't figure it out.
Well, listen, I mean, it was too short term for us what Paul wanted to do, get us in the Premier League. I thought every manager the game was to get them to the Premier League. I mean, I'm so lost for words. Paul, basically what you're doing was you were doing too good a job. That's why we're getting rid of you. You didn't even in the Derby way. I mean, what is the Derby way, for goodness sake? Is that the same as the West Ham way under Sam Allardyce?
Is that the problem then, that sort of in football at the moment, the rewards are so huge, be it Premier League promotion, be it, you know, avoiding relegation and getting a slice of that TV money. The rewards are so huge, the risk is there as well. And that's why chairmen and clubs panic and then make these decisions that sort of don't give young managers a chance.
I mean, obviously, I mean, I always bring it back to other jobs. I know that management in football is just a law unto itself. But imagine if you went into the office and you begin a new job and you're 21 or 22 and you're just out of college, and basically you're tipping away for 3 months. You made a few errors and the manager comes in and says, "Listen, to be honest, that email last week, it should have gone out at 3 o'clock rather than 5 o'clock. It's been nice knowing you. It's been great, but you know." Sorry about that. We might see each other again down the road. If you want to clear out your desk, you know. And you're like, hang on a second, what? And it's kind of like that. You're allowed one mistake. You're allowed, you know, it's just, there's just no wiggle room. And there's nothing that managers can say anymore. You can't come out and say, well, to be honest, every manager goes through rough spots. You know, show me a manager that doesn't struggle. I'll show you a lawyer, you know, something that doesn't exist. You can't say that because someone's like, oh, well, he's just shifting the blame, isn't he? You know, so I think when it comes to the young managers thing, I think the general point that I want to make is, if you look at someone like Ryan Giggs at Manchester United, who kind of is in the shadows, and everyone's like, Brian Robson, you should give it to Giggs. Why would Ryan Giggs take that job even if he wanted it? I mean, what is the best case scenario for Ryan Giggs? You'll have Manchester United supporters, you know, turning around within 6 months going, we're fifth in the league. We had it better under Van Gaal. we actually had it better under Moyes. I mean, he doesn't have a clue what he's doing. You know, it's even Klopp at Liverpool. I mean, I've made the prediction that come next season, if Liverpool, you know, after six or seven games of next term, aren't going particularly well, maybe find themselves ninth or tenth, you'll have Liverpool fans going, oh, he's lost it. He's lost the plot, this Klopp lad.
He's not got it.
He's lost it. He's gone. You cash him in. Get him someone. Get Simeone. Get Simeone instead. You know, so instead of, and Klopp is obviously a slightly older example than the other names we've been talking about. So
I think though Klopp is obviously slightly different. And then there's also any older manager, because Klopp has that sort of age behind him. Management is almost an old man's game in a way, because you need that respect, you need that experience, you need that time under your belt. And it would seem that a lot of people want these young managers to do well, but it's almost an oxymoron in that sense, because, you know, you were saying, you know, if you send a bad email or something, then that's bad. But the point is then, what most people say, you will be the player in that situation. If you send a bad email, that's you missing a goal. That's mismanagement. So it's about how you manage young people, essentially. And I think we're very quick to rush these people through. Why not give Neville a decade? You know, he'll be in his 50s by then. That's a good time to go into management. Not everyone can be Pep Guardiola. And at some point, you know, I'm not saying everyone can not reach those levels, but at the same time, there's only very few people that can, because there are very few opportunities like that. So maybe this is the apex of what we can expect right now for a lot of young managers. It's not ideal, but it's also, you know, it's not the worst.
Right, that's all we've got time for, Armin. Thank you very much for joining us.
No problem, guys. And anytime, it's been great. So, yeah, fantastic.
Where can we find your work online? If people like what you said, where would they go?
Well, probably Twitter is the best bet, because I'll throw all the links up there. But I have a regular column for Yahoo, so that can be plugged. And I write for an Irish sports website here called the42.ie. So yeah, feel free to plug away. The guys will be very happy with that.
They have it. Fascinating stuff from Owen there. I think we're going to have him back again.
I love his accent as well.
Yeah, I do love an Irish accent.
Top fella.
Anyway, listen up, guys. If you want to let us know your thoughts, your feelings, your suggestions, get us on Twitter at @TheFrontFree. Make sure you follow Owen as well. Send him some love. Lawrence, if the people want to follow you, where should they go?
Go to @Lozcast on Twitter, LOZCAST. Someone just tweeted me this morning, I want Lozcast job. And I thought, do you know what my job is?
Not sure he knows.
Yeah, not sure anyone does.
Dave, where can the good people find you?
If you type in SQUA.
Is that it?
Oh, K-A.
All right.
Just having one of those days. Spelling isn't going quite right today, guys. I apologize.
I can tell. You can follow me on Twitter at Adam Boltwood. Remember, we're going to be back on Saturday with the Q&A podcast. And next week, I'm very excited because we've got Professor Simon Chadwick on the podcast.
I know we said it would be this week, but it wasn't. We're sorry.
We really wanted to get a great guest, and this guy is going to be incredible. So next week, we'll be talking about China, the growth of football.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In the Far East and how it's affecting European football. Until Saturday, we'll see you later.